Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the world has known her as Gidget, the Flying Nun, Norma Rae, and Mary Todd Lincoln. But now actress Sally Field is revealing her own story. In her new memoir titled In Pieces, she seeks to understand her loving but complicated relationship with her mother and confronts the sexual abuse she faced as a child.
I would throw all of those feelings that were all bombarding my 8-year-old brain, my 9-year-old brain, my 10-year-old brain, I would throw them out to the tree outside. I remember that so clearly. And I would be with the tree and not in the room.
Then sexual misconduct has taken center stage at the hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as his accuser sets her terms for testifying in the Senate. The echoes of Anita Hill are unmistakable. We listen back to my 1997 conversation with Hill, in which she reflects on her experience. But first, here is Sally Field. Sally Field, what a great pleasure to meet you.
Oh, gosh, it's my pleasure to be here.
This book, I am looking at the front cover.
Yes.
And it's a photograph of a very pensive young woman with sort of anxiety written in her eyes.
Yes.
And yet the back of the book photograph is of a totally different woman.
Yes.
Tell me what happened between those two photographs.
Well, they were a lot of miles in my saddle, a lot of struggling to learn issues that I needed to learn. But ultimately, how I could put those two pictures together is that I needed to find my own story. When my mother passed away, let's see, when I was 65, so it's 7 years ago now, going on 8, I thought I had done everything I was supposed to do, meaning I'd had the conversations and we'd sat and spent time together and I'd had the hard conversations. And yet, from the moment she passed, I felt deeply disquieted, not just missing her or mourning for her, that there was something wrong, something I hadn't done, I hadn't found out, something festering on me. And I felt an urgency to figure out what that was. At the same time, serendipitously, a friend of mine who is the co-founder of the Omega Institute in upstate New York, every year they would give these fabulous weekends, Women in Power conferences they were called, and they would invite the most extraordinary women from all over the globe to speak about who they were and how they got there. And then this year, right after my mother passed away, Elizabeth called me and said, asked me if I was coming. And I said, gosh, yes, I'm going to, you know, sit in the back of the room, just be honored to be there. And she said, well, good, because I want you to give the keynote address.
Oh, my.
I'm like, what? What? I can't give a keynote. I can't possibly give a keynote address. I have nothing to say. And she said, yes, you do. And the bell rang in my head, and I knew I did. And I wrote a very, very long speech, like 45, almost an hour.
Wow.
I was shaking all over, but I had revealed pieces of myself that I hadn't verbalized, really. And I knew I had to find what I was missing. And the only way I would do that was to learn a craft and to do it as deeply as I had learned to do the craft of acting. It would force me to go to the places I didn't want to go, to look in the boxes that I had kept with me all my life of memorabilia, of memories and things that I never looked at, that I was afraid to look at letters that people had sent me, my father and others. All my life, I hid them away from me, but I didn't throw them away. So some piece of me thought, you're going to need this. Someday you're going to need this. And that someday was, you know, over 7 years ago, I began to lay all the pieces out in front of me, hoping that I could figure out how to put them together and see what it was I wasn't seeing.
Two questions. First, do you think you could have written this same book had your mother been alive?
No. Not because I would be frightened of what she was reading, which is true. I would. I think it was her loss that forced me to go here, because I really had to find things I didn't want to see, things that I had placed out of my mind. I is the only way I can say it. I mean, moments when I had written them down in my journal, closed the book, put the journal away, and completely forgot that I had heard it, that I had written it, until I finally went back and let it really connect to my brain.
Second, did you ever consider a ghostwriter?
No.
Good.
Throughout my career, for 55 years, however long this has been, there have been, you know, wonderful people, publishers and book agents, who would come to me and say, gosh, we just think you should write a memoir, and we know just who to write it for you. And I would think to myself, well, thanks, that's very nice, very flattering. I would always know that the story I really had to tell, even though at that time I wasn't sure what it wasn't anything what they thought it was. And so I would, thank you so much, but no, I'm just not right for me right now.
Sally, this book is so extraordinary. It felt to me as though you were writing in your own diary. This whole book, you were writing a letter, a very long letter, to yourself, opening to yourself those long-buried thoughts.
That's what I was doing. I absolutely was doing that. And many times I would go to the only craft I really know, and that is the craft of acting. And I would use some of the tools that I've learned to explore characters, in some of the exercises that I was taught at the Actor's Studio from Lee Strasberg. And I would go into these exercises that begin always with relaxation and slight meditation, and then put myself in these places that I didn't want to go again. Memories, rooms, episodes. And then it would, you know, it would just come flying out. Of course, it took me 7 years, because after it came flying out, I then was like possessed to learn, you know, the magnificent craft of putting a sentence together, reading everybody I could read, and having certain books literally open out in front of me all the time to look at, wait, how the heck does John Updike write that sentence to be so seemingly simple and yet say so much? So I was also profoundly working as hard as I could to get an education about something I have always loved, and that is words.
I want to ask you first about one of those very painful episodes in your life regarding your stepfather and how that whole episode, that part of your life, you felt so isolated that you kept crying into yourself, Mom, where are you? Where are you?
You know, Diane, what's interesting, and it's what I needed to explore. I needed to put myself back in that room at that moment, that little girl that was 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. I needed to go there, because that voice that's crying out is how I'm seeing it now, finally hearing my own voice that was calling out, because I didn't allow myself to hear it then. I couldn't allow myself to feel how deeply I wanted my mother to come and get me. And I do know that the survival techniques that I trained myself to have to help me get through this complicated time, because I also adored my stepfather. I needed him to love me. And I was being taught that this is what love is, that it has to be dangerous, terrifying, because if it is, then you're actually seen and cared for, but there's something deeply dangerous, ticking always. And I would throw all of those feelings that were all bombarding my 8-year-old brain, my 9-year-old brain, my 10-year-old brain, I would throw them out to the tree outside. I remember that so clearly, watching the tree, and because I could see its limbs and the leaves, and I can hear the rustling that sounded like water when the sycamore tree would blow in the wind, and I would be with the tree and not in the room.
Describe the scene for us.
Oh boy, that's hard to do. It's so hard for me to even write it on the page. I can only say, talk as difficult it is for me to verbalize, as you can see, I begin to stutter. Just that I was called to his room and asked to walk on his back. He was in bed. It was morning. He didn't have clothes on. I had a nightgown on, and I can't say any more than it just throughout the years advanced. It's harder for me to verbalize than it is. I had to just put words on a page to do it, because I can't. I guess if you and I were sitting somewhere alone and we had a glass of wine, I could sit with you for a minute. But even to this day, I feel something clawing on my insides when I begin to go there, and my hands start to shake.
Do you think that your mother knew, number one, mm-hmm. where you were, mm-hmm. and number two, what you were doing?
I thought my mother did know where I was, but it seemed so innocent. He was a stuntman. He was always had a sore back. I was so tiny. From the first moment I came into his life, he came into my life. I was 4. I was such a little doll-like figure because I was so tiny. And he would, you know, do acrobatics with me and hold me in the air and throw me around. And I was terrified. I didn't want to do that. But I was being noticed. I was being touched. And my real father wasn't able to do that at all. I was completely ignored. And yet I was forced to spend long periods of time with him, long weekends, where I can't remember we even had a... We talked a little bit, I guess, but it was basically, what would you want to eat? And the isolation of that, the being ignored, was equally terrifying. I, as a little child at 5, and I remember feeling terrified of the aloneness, and I couldn't express anything that was going on inside of me. From the beginning of my relationship with my real father, I felt it was my job to take care of him. Somehow that was, you know, that piece of information was handed to me without words. I was too little for anybody to say that, but I could feel it. There's you know, a dialogue that goes on without words. And children, boy, at 4, they read that dialogue.
Your mother was such a gorgeous woman. Mm-hmm. She was married to your father for how long?
I think she was married to my real father, not very long, really, because they got married right before he went away into the war, World War II, and was sent to Europe. So I think they were married for two years before he left, a year and a half before he left. And when he left, she was pregnant with my older brother, who's 2.5 years older. And he was gone for almost 4 years. And then when he came back, my brother was 2.5, going on 3. And I was born shortly after that. And then she left him when I was 3.5.
And married Jocko.
And married Jocko.
pretty...
Very quickly, yeah. Very
That's
quickly after. So Jocko came into my life when I was almost 4.
Your mother and Jocko then had another child.
Yes.
A little girl.
Yes.
Whom they named?
Princess.
Princess.
Yes. My very tall little sister, who is...
I've seen her peeking over
yes.
your shoulder.
And thank God for her. She's my darling sister. And yes, I do remember very clearly Jocko coming home from the hospital because I was 5, a little over 5 by then, something. And he said he always wanted his own little princess. So he named her Princess.
And yet you were the favored one.
It was never said that I was, but there was a great deal of focus on me by my stepfather. But there was a great deal of focus on my brother, too, but in such a terrible, negative, ultimately negative. It didn't start out that way. It started out to seem as if Jocko was trying to encourage us because we had come, we didn't know how to ride a bike or swim or anything. We'd lived with my grandmother and her sisters and my mother, and it was a very protected, closed female environment. We didn't have bicycles or roller skates or, we ran around the backyard. But so as far as Jocko was concerned, we needed to have these skills. And I agree, a child shouldn't know how to ride a bike. But he always did it in such a way, it was such a grand scale that the bikes were always way too big and too...
With a nothing boy's was right. bar.
A boy's bike for me, that was really meant for 11-year-old Schwinn. It was a gorgeous Schwinn bike. But I was a tiny 7-year-old and... I could barely get my leg over the top of it. So try to learn how to ride a bike on that. But, ultimately I did. And at first, his devotion to Ricky, my brother, and me, we just thought he was the sun and the moon and the stars.
You adored him.
Adored him. Except he was frightening. There was always this caveat. It seemed to go together. To be loved and seen, you had to be terrified. And, there is a saying that psychologically what's fired together is wired together. So the pattern of behavior, that it was the survival mechanisms and the pattern of behavior that was imprinting in my brain is really what the book is about and how long it has taken me to try to undo that pattern.
How do you think he and your mother got along?
I think they were madly in love with each other, just absolutely crazed for each other that I could see. But again, I was a little kid. But as time went on, and it was now the 50s, there was a whole lot of alcohol became part of their lives. A lot of vodka. But as my stepfather's career first was like on such a up trajectory, and then slam, all of a sudden it hit a snag, which careers do. That's exactly what you gotta be prepared for because that's gonna happen. But he couldn't. He, on that first real slam in his work, it affected him in a really powerful way. Not to stop and take a look at yourself and how did this happen? What's next? What do I want to do? How do I move there? What's standing in my way that I can fix within myself? It began to take an ugly toll on him and the marriage and my mother, and alcohol became a big ingredient.
Let's talk about Gidget and how Gidget came about.
It came about because something was out there looking out for me. When I graduated from high school in 1964, I had no vision of the future, and I didn't at that point have a family around me looking out for me. No one said, "What are you going to do tomorrow? Are you going to go to college?" My brother had prepared for this when he had graduated from high school, like two years earlier. He had worked for, secretly, because he didn't tell me, he had worked for and achieved a gymnastics scholarship because we didn't have any money in my family at all. He had accomplished it and received a gymnastics scholarship to Berkeley. And he was also on his way to being an elemental particle physicist. He got his doctorate there at Berkeley and became, you know, a very well-regarded scientist in this country and in the world. He works at CERN. But I didn't see him as a role model. I couldn't see into the future. Part of my survival mechanism was creating fog around myself so that I couldn't see anything other than the drama department and what scene was I doing next in Birmingham High School drama department. And that was pretty much it. So when I graduated, I began to panic in a way because where was my stage? The stage was what I had found when I was 12, and I was lucky enough to have a drama department when they still had theater arts departments in public school. Thank God.
Thank God.
And it's just an absolute tragedy that people don't realize that the arts needs to be included in schools. We need to understand that children who might not have another way to do it, the arts is a way to express what's going on inside that they can't verbalize. And that's what it was for me. And it was the only place that I could hear myself, that I could hear my own voice. And even though that voice didn't include anything that was going on at home, it certainly allowed me to be in the moment at that second on that stage and react to that person the way I really felt. Were they going to like me or
you
dislike me?
You were free.
I was just free. I was free. And it was like a bell had rung and the fog had cleared. And so my need to get to that was this driving urge in my life, not to get to a career, but to get to those moments where I felt alive. And so I had no stage. I graduated from high school. What was I going to do? Where was I going to go? And my stepfather had heard of a workshop. Now, I didn't even have in my mind the thought that there was, wait a minute, there's New York. There are places to study. You can go to the, you know, this, because at that point, certainly, Lee Strasberg was very much alive and the Actor's Studio was very much a viable place. But I had never been on an airplane or out of the state. It didn't occur to me how could I get on an airplane? I didn't have 10 cents. So this workshop was located at Columbia Pictures in Hollywood. I had to audition to get in. I did a scene with my mother from Toys in the Attic, Lillian Hellman's very complicated play, which I never bothered to read the whole thing, just the one scene. Who knew you had to read the whole play, for goodness sakes? And I was accepted into this workshop. And
you didn't think you would be.
Well, of course I thought I would be because I was the queen of the drama department in Birmingham High School. I knew how to do this. Huh. It was what I knew. It was all I knew. Because all of those years of being on stage, doing scenes, and then doing all of the term plays and everything I possibly could, I would run for office not because I wanted the office, but because I wanted to give the speech. And yet, I was so cripplingly shy and awkward with people. I felt that way and, terribly anxious. And so when I got into the workshop, I was standing on the corner the second night of the class, or I think it was the second night. It met once a week. And or maybe it was the first night, after the first meeting, and the casting man from Screen Gems, which is affiliated with Columbia at the time, Columbia Pictures, and at Sunset and Gower, this is where it was located, and came out and asked me if I wanted to come on an interview the next day. Asked me who my agent was, and of course I said, I don't know. So my stepfather brought me, Jocko brought me to that meeting the next day, and I tested and tested and retested and met and read the entire summer of 1964, And by that September, like mid-September, something like that, I was called, and I had gotten the role, and it was for a television series called Gidget. So, bam.
Did you want it?
Oh, gosh. I desperately wanted it. It was the first beginnings of feeling, and I don't know that I even registered how much I wanted it. I just had my head down, as I say now. My head was down. I was getting it. No matter what anybody else thought, I was going to get this.
And then, all of a sudden, you worked on that for how long?
Well, it in those days, so it was the 65 season or something, it was 38 shows, something. And nowadays, it's, you know, 13. Yeah,
exactly.
Or, even when I did a series later on in the, whatever it was, 2005, it was, you know, 22 or 21 or 19. So this was 38 shows. So it was big. It was your year, basically.
Right.
But it was canceled because in those days, the three networks, and there were only three, they never moved shows around to find their key audience. They didn't do the kind of research that they do now to really see where do we need to target this. And the kids that were basically it was targeted for, it belonged to, were in school. And they, you know, when it was on at whatever it was, 8 o'clock at night, and they were either doing homework, something I never did, but hopefully they were. Then when it was taken off and put on for summer reruns, it became a big hit. And yet they had already canceled it. And in those days, they just never, ever said, oops, let's bring it back on. And so they wanted, ABC wanted to find another show to put me in.
And then came the offer for The Flying Nun.
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't want to do it.
I know you didn't.
Not in any way. That summer, I had actually gone off and I had, after Gidget was canceled, I had gone on two meetings. I actually had an agent now. And I think the agent was very surprised I went on two meetings. And I think he was even more surprised when from those meetings I got two different offers. One of them was for stage version in the valley where I live in the San Fernando Valley. It was in Woodland Hills or Tarzan or something. And a theater in the round to do a play with the wonderful Walter Pidgeon called Take Her, She's Mine. And just, I mean, Walter Pidgeon, I had always just adored. But I chose to do the film offer that came in, which was for a Western with Kurt Douglas and Robert Mitchum and Richard Widmark. And I had done that over the summer. And when I got back, I had moved out of my house, was in an apartment. There was a script waiting for me, and it was The Flying Nun. And I absolutely didn't want to do it. There was a tiny, tiny little flash of light that had started to go through my brain of what it was I really wanted to do. I wanted to learn to act. I wanted to be a good actor. It's where I lived. It's what made me alive. And I had to find a way to get to it. And this was not it. And and not only that, this was in the mid-60s, and all hell was breaking loose in my generation. And I didn't want to just sign up as part of the establishment, especially because I had real negative feelings about Catholicism, because that's what my real father was, and he had taken me to church. And it wasn't that I had any, you know, I didn't understand Catholicism. I only knew it through my father, who would, it was a way to sort of give me mean looks because I wasn't sitting still, and I didn't understand any of it, and why I felt just disapproved of. I had to hit myself and ask for forgiveness, and I didn't know what I had done. And so I didn't want to be a nun. I wanted to be exploring sexuality and craziness, and this wasn't going to do it. But my stepfather came to my new apartment. I hadn't seen him, and said that the studio had called him, and ultimately he said, if I didn't do it, I may never work again.
Oh, my.
And I did it for the worst of all reasons, and that was that I was afraid.
You were afraid you would never work again.
Absolutely. I had no reason to think that I would, except this little, like I said, some little flash of light that said, yes, you will. Yes, you will. And I couldn't let it, that voice was not strong enough yet. Not yet.
You know, I want to jump forward now to Burt Reynolds, mm-hmm. who died recently.
Yes.
And you said in an interview that you're glad he didn't read mm-hmm. what you wrote.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me why.
Well, I mean, it's hard for me to sort of evaluate the kind of picture I painted of him. I think I paint a picture of somebody who's a human being, who's under tremendous pressures that he isn't able to grapple with, just as to a degree I'm painting a picture of the pressures that I was trying to grapple with. But Bert never wanted to see the real me, really. He wanted me to be what he thought I was. And
what did he think you were?
Well, he said he had initially wanted me to work with him on Smokey and the Bandit because he liked Gidget. So I think that gives you kind of right there a picture of what he thought I was, who he thought I was. And I, even at the beginning, when I tried to be who I was, tried to come into the room with him, I felt, just as I did as a child, these unspoken demands that I not be that way, that I be, that I don't do that, that I don't say that, that I don't go there, and I could hear this, whether he was actually asking me or not, but I think he pretty much was. Without saying it, I felt, you know, popped on the nose with a rolled up newspaper of behave this way and not this way. And it was a preformed rut in my road. It was a system of behavior I was used to. I had already been taught to love someone, and to the feelings of love, you have to feel it's dangerous, and you have to then disappear.
You talk in the book about something that I think many people are going to be surprised that a film actress such as yourself admits to, and that is to having had mm-hmm. an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you sort of blocked it out.
Yes, I certainly did.
Your mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you tell anyone else? I know your mother was in the car mm-hmm. with you. Doctor somebody mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. his wife were mm-hmm. in the car.
The family doctor. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever tell anyone else before you wrote this book?
I don't think so. I think my sister knew, but I'm not sure. But I know Steve, my wonderful high school sweetheart, my first husband, and probably if I had a soulmate ever in my life, it was Steve.
It was Steve.
And it wasn't even his. And he was waiting for me on the front steps of the house where I lived when I got back. And he enfolded me in his arms and said, don't talk, don't talk, don't talk. And he took me into the house and put me to bed and nursed me, cared for me, and held me when I cried. And I don't think I talked about it. It's hard for me to talk about it now. It's hard for me not to want to cry now. Anybody, but especially older white men who sit in a panel and think they can tell women what's right to do with their body, they're wrong. If they think for 1 minute that those decisions are ever easy or painless, they're wrong, and they have no right. I could not have had a child then. That child would have been in terrible trouble, and it would have destroyed me. So I feel that I had a right to live at that point, more than a cluster of cells. So that's my feeling, even though at the time I had no awareness. I couldn't see any of that. I couldn't see right or wrong or even decision. I couldn't have survived.
Sally Field, I want to congratulate you once again on this beautiful, beautiful book and the effort and your heart that you put into it. It's really to be applauded.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I can arrange to change any doubts you feel. Wait till you see my gadget.
Now a quick break. When I come back, an excerpt from my 1997 interview with Anita Hill.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Republican senators have suggested the accusations made by Christine Blasey Ford against Brett Kavanaugh are a case of mistaken identity. President Trump has questioned why she remained silent after the alleged assault, saying if it was as bad as she says, she would have filed a police report. Listening to this, I can't help thinking about Anita Hill and what she told me about her experience.
Do you believe that there was a predisposition against your testimony from the moment you opened your mouth?
Well, even before I came to Washington, there was a stated predisposition against my testimony. There were statements made by senators even before I had said anything to them. There, after the press conference in particular, there were statements made by the senators. Even President Bush himself said that this was part of a smear campaign. Even on the Democratic side, Senator DeConcini had said that, you know, I shouldn't have come forward or given the impression that I shouldn't have come forward, that, you know, women who are sexually harassed ought to take action. They ought to get angry and they ought to take immediate action. And so he misrepresented what had happened at the time that I sent my statement forward, saying that I had sent it forward anonymously or called up anonymously. So there was this misinformation and expressions of predisposition.
All right, here in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hello, Neil. You're on the air.
I didn't watch too much of the hearings, and I've never really been all that concerned about whether the allegations were true or not. I have a very basic question, which is, let's assume that everything you said was true. He did what you said, and he lied about it afterwards. Does that invalidate him, in your opinion, from being confirmed as Supreme Court Justice?
Well, let me tell you why I think it's irrelevant. I think it goes to his judgment. I think it goes to his feeling of being a sense of himself as above the law, even the law that he is there to enforce.
Right.
And when you take that into account with the fact that he is going to be making decisions for the entire country, then an individual who thinks that he is above the law can find ways to put other people above the law, too. So I do think, yes, it does invalidate him, unless there is some way that you could see that, that there has been some change or some regret for this behavior and a disavowal of this kind of behavior. And I don't think that that was coming. It was a complete denial of the behavior. So, again, I think the complete denial itself makes the point that I can be above the law. I can act in this way. And I should go unpunished. There should be no adverse results to this behavior. I should never be accountable.
Okay, well, I would just make the observation that, leaving aside for the moment whether or not I think Clarence Thomas just per se was a good choice for Supreme Court Justice, there have been a lot of leaders in this country and in other countries over the centuries who have had less than perfect personal lives and have done things that people would not agree, who ultimately made very good leaders. And I'm not saying that he makes a very good justice or makes a very bad justice, but I would suggest that, in my personal opinion, a lot more attention was paid to that than to the kinds of issues that I want my justices to be chosen for, which is their stance and their views on how they're going to judge laws. But thank you for taking my call.
But let me make one follow-up comment.
Okay. Yes,
I think, unfortunately, we are seeing the court as a political body. I think when you talk about a lot of good leaders, you may be referring to political leaders. We're talking about a lifetime appointment on the court of last resort. And that's a very different position than an elected position or an appointed position to the Department of State or even the Justice Department. We're talking about a lifetime appointment to a court that is charged with being fair and impartial. So I think let's not blur the lines here and think that the person that who might make a good president will necessarily make a good Supreme Court justice. The charge is higher.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Do you have any regret that you came forward?
You know, no, I don't regret that I came forward. Sometimes I think I wish I had done so earlier in the process. Mm. I think perhaps that's the only element that might have changed things. But then I'm not sure that it would have changed anything.
What do you think it might have changed?
Well, I think had I come forward earlier, there might have been more time to investigate the claim, if there was in fact going to be a fair investigation. There might have been more time to establish a procedure for hearing my statement. But on the other hand, the Republican senators were so determined to get this nomination through that there would have probably been more time for them to establish their campaign against me.
You can find my entire 1997 interview with Anita Hill at dianereem.org. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week was Josephine Naunai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.